Hello, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. My name is Brian, and this is Honey Badger Radio. And today is the Fireside Chat at a special day and time. And my special guest is, I hope I'm saying this right, Lucien Valsan. Is that right?
Close enough. Hello.
Hello, Lucien. Welcome to Honey Badger Radio.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. You, from what I remember, you used to work with AVFM quite frequently years ago. What did you do there? Do you remember, or can you tell us a little bit about it?
Technically, I still do work for A Voice for Men, although recently I haven't been able to produce as much things as I used to. Mm-hmm. On paper, I'm still the European news director for A Voice for Men, and that has been my thing since 2011, so about 8 years now. And I also used to do a show called AVFM Voice of Europe, which I've done until early 2018-ish, so mm-hmm. for about 6 years. I abruptly stopped doing it at first because I lost access to the email with which I would coordinate stuff. Then I regained the access, but I just didn't have the time to do it.
Right.
A lot more bigger stuff basically have emerged on my plate. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't able to continue to do it. At some point in the future, maybe I'll be able again, once I'll be able to hire an assistant basically to carry out with the administrative stuff.
Okay. So you still have an interest in the stuff. It's just that you've taken on lots of bigger projects and maybe even like a wider scope of things. Mm. I mean, that's what it seems to me anyway. I watched a couple of your videos on your current YouTube channel, Freedom Alternative, which I put links to everything you guys can see. Freedom Alternative YouTube channel, as well as the freedomalternative.com website. And the Freedom Alternate is actually the Twitter. It's all alternative without the A-T-I-V, or I'm sorry, the I-V-E at the end. So you've been doing this for a while.
Twitter didn't allow it entirely. So
you just ran out of characters. So, but yeah, I have the link in there. So if you've been doing this for about 8 years, that kind of makes you a veteran, right?
I've been doing it for about 8 years in English.
Yes.
My interest in non-feminism runs for more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. And writing about it is about 15 years. But I haven't been writing in English until, I think, 2010 or 2011. That's when mm-hmm. I started writing in English. Yes. Mm.
Oh, okay. So you've been doing this a lot longer. So I guess actually, as someone who's so kind of, in my opinion, newer to this than you are, and based on all of the various conversations that I've had with all kinds of people and all the content that's been put out there, how do you think the MRM is doing?
It's actually doing much better than I expected. I mean, if you mm-hmm. had told me in 2010 or 2011 that by the end of the decade, there will be a president of the United States who got elected after saying outright that women have it better than men, I would have called you a lunatic. I would say, no, that's not impossible. It would have to take at least 10 years until we get to that level of conversation. It actually took less than five. So that was good. Again, if you had told me 5 years ago in 2014 that open contesting of things like Title IX, the Dear Colleague Letter, or things of that nature would have become mainstream discussion, again, I would have said that, yeah, that's probably not going to be the case, not in 5 years for sure, maybe a little bit longer, but it did happen. In terms of political achievements, it's actually much better than I expected. Now, mm-hmm. in terms of wider conversations, it's pretty much going how I expected, namely that after the initial enthusiasm in 2009, 2010, and especially 2011 and 12, it would have necessarily had to split into multiple sub-threads of discussion. So you now have, as opposed to 2011, when it was basically avoiceformen.com and a few other smaller ones, but basically the discussion was on avoicefromen.com. I expected it at the time that it will eventually have to split into multiple threads, and it did, because, you know, you have on one hand the people interested in the history of things, such as the gynocentrism.com, which are doing a fantastic job over there. Then you have the more youthful and women's perspective, things like Honey Badger Brigade, and then and then you have the, of course, the more militant wing of the MGTOW community, which is found mostly on YouTube, and to which I'm not a big fan of, but that's a different story. There's all sorts of different subthreads of the discussion that have now emerged as their own institutions in a way. Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad thing at all. I mean, one of the objectives that we set out to do 9 years ago or 8 years ago was precisely to become, to quote Fidel Bogan here, to become ambient. That is to say, non-feminist ideas and non-feminist way of looking at the world, or worldviews, if you want, to become just part of a wider conversation, to no longer be just the defining factor. And that was very important to be achieved, and it has, at least in part, already been achieved, because at the end of the day, non-feminism is just one facet of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And of course, once you get to become ambient, as Fidel Bogan put it 10 years ago, is basically to come to the moment when non-feminism is assumed, which was very important to achieve because at the end of the day, most of the people are non-feminist. I'm sure about this. I mean, think about it. In the United Kingdom, there is even multiple surveys to show this, that only about 8 or 9% of women and about 5% of men are even willing to declare themselves feminists. Mm-hmm. And we can safely assume that at least half of those have no idea what the word actually means in practice. So, you know, feminism is not just a minority position. It's a minuscule, marginal minority position. Most of the people are just not feminists. And once it has become a lot more clear in mainstream conversations, the effects that the feminist ideology has on lifestyles and on regular people in the end, that percentage will have to and has continued to drop and will have to continue to drop over the next 4 or 5 years. About it, double standards in family courts were a forbidden conversation in most of Europe and most of North America 8 years ago. Today, they're pretty much open knowledge. In the meantime, we are able to find mainstream books available on New York Times best-selling list or things like that, that are openly non-feminist. And I'm thinking here about, Dr. Helen Smith's books or even Jordan Peterson. These things have changed in a dramatical way very fast. But of course, the biggest results we're going to have to wait for at least another decade to see them, because changing the narrative at a historical scale, that takes time. In the past, it used to take at least 3 generations. Now, with the speed that with which the information circulates, we may be able to get it done in 20 or 25 years, but it still requires several decades. You cannot just move the mountains in a few years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on a civilizational scale, we're moving pretty well.
Okay. All right. Well, there was some the reason why I asked you about this non-feminist thing is, in the United States, we have there are studies that have been done that parallel the same thing, where very few people identify with the label of feminist. It's something in the 20-25% of people in the U.S. However, on the other end of this is that while most people don't tend to identify as feminists, most people do seem to agree with most feminist positions if asked about those positions, even if they don't themselves consider themselves feminists. And I wonder if the reason why people don't identify as feminist isn't because they disagree with the things that feminists proclaim, like patriarchy theory, like rape culture, like the wage gap, you know, and all these sorts of myths that are put out there. But it's rather because they either know that there's something kind of icky about the label of feminist, or they think that taking on the label feminist means that you spend a lot of your time doing activism, and they might not be people who do any activism. They might say, well, I'm not an activist. I don't protest, but I agree that, domestic violence is a women's issue. I agree that rape culture exists. I agree that there is a wage gap. You know, it's almost like, and this is the thing that's really tough about fighting against feminism. I wonder if those studies are misleading in that while it may be important to feminists that people call themselves feminists, it's more important to in the larger sort of cultural conversation that people put away those feminist myths, which are so mainstream, they're not even considered to be feminist. They're just considered to be sort of, you know, reality, right?
I don't know the answer to that because I'm not in the mind of most people most of the time. So I don't know the answer to that. But if I'm allowed to speculate,
sure.
It is basically the case of first you win the labels game, then you win the propaganda game, and only at the end you win the issues game. This is where I think many militant non-feminists, because again, it's not only MRAs who are involved in this. There are many other non-feminists who are not necessarily MRAs, but many non-feminists have gone about it the other way around, have gone about it issues first. And I understand why. I mean, at the end of the day, the reason most non-feminists become involved in countering feminist mythology is because they care about the issues. So it's perfectly understandable.
Sure.
But from a propaganda war perspective, which is the perspective that I fully embraced about 5 years ago, it's not how change happens. You first have to win the labels game, and which pretty much we won. And now it's winning the propaganda war itself. And then at the end of the day, you discuss at the end of the process, you discuss the issues. Again, this is not particularly spectacular. I mean, this is how the mainstream discussion about communism went as well. At first, you had to win the labels game, not getting people to no longer call themselves communists. And then you won the effective propaganda war. And then only at the end, you deal with the issues. I mean, deregulation and shrinking the role of the state. They only intervened like 70 years into the battle against communism. Why? Because those are always at the end of it, and I understand the issues are important, but only we could only be able to address those only when we started making some inroads into debunking many of the feminist myths that you are that you already outlined. And we're around half of that process, maybe a third into that process, maybe half would be a bit too optimistic. I mean, just recently we saw the New York Times, for instance, publishing, admittedly, they didn't like it, but they had to publish it, the study, the internal study by Google, was meant to address the gender wage gap. And it turns out there is one against men.
No, I agree. There's definitely been, I've seen, for example,
such news, I apologize for interrupting, but such news would have been impossible to even imagine 8 or 9 years ago.
No, I agree with that. I think that you make a good point about the labels war and the propaganda war. I didn't realize that in many ways I was fighting the labels war because the feminists are trying to win that war as well. That's why for them it's so important that people call themselves feminists. And whenever they make a video defending feminist ideas, they don't talk about the issues. They talk about the label. They try to get people to understand that if you care about women, you have to call yourself this. And for them, it's important, right? And
it is important, and it is because unlike 10 or 15 years ago, now they've already started losing on every single front, and they know that once they entirely lose the labels war, it's all going downhill from there. I mean, look, the feminists on YouTube or the Anita Sarkeesians of the world, they're not particularly bright. But the people who actually write the propaganda for the feminists, they're very intelligent because otherwise they would not have been able to dominate society for so many decades. I mean, they're not idiots. They're definitely very intelligent. And those people, they understand fairly well. That's why you see them investing so much into small-time propagandists meant to counteract the non-feminist narrative, because they know that once that particular front is lost, then it will be very difficult for them to maintain the grip on society. And also, you have to remember, many of the feminists are feminists because they're being paid to be feminists.
Oh, yeah.
This is particularly true in Europe, where the European Union pays a lot. I'm talking here to the tunes of more than 10 billion euros per year just in feminist-oriented programs. And in the United States, all of those people who deal with so-called domestic violence shelters, who are actually there only to further false allegations of domestic violence and such, all of them are paid through the programs by what's it called, the VAWA, Violence Against Women Act. Mm-hmm. And you see them coming out of the woodwork defending their own little quote unquote jobs, basically, you know, their little kingdom whenever VAWA is up for reconfirmation and it fails to get confirmed, like it happened this year in January.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So do you think that, well, let me just say to the chat, if you guys have any questions or comments for us, just send us a super chat and I'll read it out loud in the conversation. So I have this... I have a tendency to push back on anything that I know is untrue, even with people who I like or otherwise agree with. For example, some of the most common things that I hear from anti-feminist YouTubers and, you know, people who create content in whatever form are things that I know to be untrue based on, you know, my knowledge of feminism's history and just the history of men and women in general, such as mm-hmm. things like, you know, feminism was necessary during the suffrage movement or was necessary in the 1960s or, you know, things like women have been oppressed throughout history up until recently or feminism is necessary in the Middle East or in these other mm-hmm. sort of Islamic countries.
Yeah, most of the people who tout that feminism is necessary in the Middle East have never been in the Middle East. It's really that fucking simple. I mean, there's no way you can believe that unless you've never been in the Middle East. Or if you have been, you've only been in a tourist resort or something like that, mm-hmm. and you've never actually been in the Middle East. That is to say, go outside of the touristy areas. No, feminism is as needed as cancer is. There is no need for it neither in India nor in the Middle East nor in mm-hmm. Africa nor anywhere, and it has never been needed. If you want, I have a very nice story. I think I told it. I said it in one of the videos. I don't know if I've published the video yet, but I have a very interesting story with feminists in a certain African country.
Oh, let's hear it. Let's hear it. Feminists in Africa. I want to hear that.
Yeah, a bunch of they call themselves well-intended Western feminists. I kind of disagree with that too, but let's call them the way they want it. They ended up in an African village where they noticed that the water to power that village was fetched mostly by women from a well that was located about 7 kilometers away from the middle of the village. And they said, oh, this is terrible. Women are being oppressed by being asked to fetch water for the whole village. So they decided, without asking the women in the village, that they will be building a well in the middle of the village so as to spare women from the burden of fetching water from 7 kilometers away. So they did. They built, without asking anyone, basically, they built a well in the middle of the village. About 2 days after the inauguration, they needed private security to get the feminists out there without being lynched by the women of the village.
Wow.
As it turns out, the villagers were not idiots. So, you know, because the area was in a high danger of malaria, the village had to be built in a crammed fashion. Mm-hmm. So in order to be easier to protect everyone from malaria, rather than if you built it with bigger distances between the accommodation, then it would have been more difficult to protect everyone from getting malaria. So the village had to be built in a grand fashion. That meant that putting the well in the middle of the village would have been quite a problem because that would have increased the risk of other diseases such as typhoid fever or cholera. So they had to put the well a little bit further from the village. And because the city was crammed, that meant you could not have sex properly without the whole of the village seeing you. So another idea was, okay, let's put the well even further away from the middle of the village so as, you know, women would go to fetch water and then their husbands would follow 1 or 2 minutes later. Mm-hmm. And yes, they would, of course, fetch water, but in the meantime also get their quickie in peace. So basically the well-intended feminists ruined the sex lives of the whole village while attempting to address the oppression of women.
Yes, yes. And of course, they angered the women more than anybody else.
Of course, yeah. Yes.
Which is what they typically do.
In the end, they have to physically move the village in order to restore order. This is why I don't agree with this idea that feminism is needed in X area of the world.
Mm-hmm. Or an X period of time. Yeah.
Or an X period of time. But especially with current days. I mean, I've traveled in more than 90 countries so far and on all continents. And I have yet to see a country where I could say, yeah, okay, maybe feminism is needed. I just don't know of such country. And again, I haven't been through all of the countries in the world. There are about 190 of all. So I still have another 100 to go. Maybe there is one. But I've been already in more than half. And not really.
Are there any countries you've been to that don't have feminism at all?
No.
That almost
I've been in several countries that have a very low degree of feminism,
like Poland
like Poland, I don't know, Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, Ukraine would be another country that has a very low degree of feminism, Albania. Mm-hmm. But countries with no feminism, I have yet to see one. Maybe they do exist, but I haven't seen one yet.
Sounds like a lot of countries that kind of like, you know, dealt with communism already that seem to have the lowest amounts of feminism.
Yeah, although that correlation is also, there is degrees to it. For instance, I've just been to Zimbabwe, a country that just came out of a brutal communist dictatorship under Robert Mugabe. And the degree of feminism there is much higher than in most of Western Europe, for instance. It's one of the countries which would actually need a lot of militant anti-feminism at this point, because it's one of the countries where it is part of the official data that domestic violence is a men's issues, you know, issue in a way. Women are the aggressors, like the primary aggressor in most of the cases. So, you know, I mean, there is a correlation there, of course. Dealing with a communist totalitarian regime tends to lower most of the people's tolerance to feminism, but it's not an absolute correlation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, going back to what you were saying about the labels game and the propaganda game, I want you to lay that out so that we can see where it's coming from. Cause I tend to only talk about, you know, the facts. Like, what I want is the truth. And that's what I try to bring up whenever we talk about a story or we're looking at an argument that's being put forward by feminists and gynocentric conservatives and that kind of thing. And I think there's a bit of overlap in that, but maybe there is some value to this idea of you know, playing the labels game and then playing the propaganda game.
Yeah, I'm not sure we'll be able to have time for that. I mean, that's why I make videos that are 2 hours long, because there is a lot to unpack.
Okay,
but I'll try the shorter version. Essentially, I mean, for starters, the word propaganda gets a very bad reputation when in reality it's a concept that's been around. I mean, the name propaganda derives from the Vatican. It's about 500 years old. And the practice of propaganda goes back at least 3,000 years old, if not more. So it's not something that the feminists invented yesterday in civilizational terms, or the communists invented the day before yesterday in civilizational terms. This has been around forever. Why? Because most people function on narratives. The way people look at the world is not like an Oxford debate society. It's more like a story, a narrative. That's how people look at the world. Most people, yeah, sure, you may be interested in facts only, but most people aren't.
Right, right.
And that's never going to change, or at least it's not going to change during my lifetime or your grandchildren's lifetimes. It's going to stay the same for a very long time from now on. Maybe, I don't know, maybe 500 years from now, the human civilization will achieve the utopian wisdom as to only look at the facts. And I don't think that will happen ever. But if it will, it's going to have to be many, many centuries from now on. So for the time being, you know, looking at the teachings of history, the only conclusion is that people look at the world through a narrative. That's how that's how we function as people. And even you and I will function like that most of the time. Yeah, sure, we look at some politics through a perspective of facts only, but we still look at other things like a narrative.
Yeah, that's why there's a Bible. I mean, that's why we have religion.
Not just the Bible. I mean, even the Bible is relatively new. I mean, the Old Testament is pretty old to function like that. But even before that, most civilizations have needed a narrative in order to resist or to withstand the test of time for more than one or two centuries. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no civilization that has been able to exist for more than two centuries that didn't have an overreaching narrative. And the opposite is also true. No civilization has been able to sustain itself once it collapsed, either intentionally or by mistake, its overreaching narrative. And we are now, I mean, this civilization is in the point where it's trying really hard to collapse its own overreaching narrative. And if that were to happen, well, you know, the teachings of history are pretty clear. And unlike many of the modern ideologues, I'm not under the impression that I know better than 10,000 years of history. I think 10,000 of years of history, they know better than I do.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the way it is. So once you understand this fact, then it becomes a lot easier to understand that you have to fight the... Well, and again, this works for any political position. It works for feminists. It works for non-feminists. It works for, I don't know, anarchists, communists, you name
whatever.
It. Once you understand that people only look at the world mostly through narratives, then it becomes a lot easier to understand why one should fight the narrative war a lot more than the facts war. I mean, the facts war is pretty simple. Feminism is wrong. End of time. End of discussion. It still doesn't count. I mean, no matter how many times you prove feminism wrong, it still doesn't change much. What does change is once you convince enough individuals to actually practice worldview that feminism is wrong and adopt other worldviews essentially. And there are many ways to address that. But all of them require a lot of time. But the easiest one, quote unquote, easiest one is through by example. I mean, if we get, let's say, in a country like Germany, if we get 4 million people to be successful whilst at the same time being not just non-feminist, but non-leftist in general, then those people can serve as an example. And then after a while, a lot more than 4 million will become non-feminist and non-leftist, because it's clearly that those people know something. They're a lot more successful, and most people will start asking, what is their narrative? So then it becomes easier. But that takes time. Yeah. The other version also takes time, is through the political process, through agitation, propaganda, subversion, basically subverting as many institutions as possible and getting them to work on promoting a narrative that is non-feminist or non-leftist, preferably both. But that one takes time too. But these are the only two approaches that are known in recent history to actually work. All the others ended up eventually fading away as, you know, naive idealists who may or may not have had a point, but they're basically naive idealists.
Right.
So, you know, I'm not saying that these are the only two courses of action that everyone should consider and ignore all the others. But I am saying that I'm not aware in history of any other course of action that actually achieved fundamental civilizational change. Because again, we're fighting an ideology that has at least attempted to, and to a certain extent succeeded in achieving fundamental civilizational change. And reversing that will have to require an equally strong force and an equally well-organizing force.
And you know what? The left is doing that. I think that's why one of the most, I guess, visible things that seem to be happening, visible conflicts, is what people are calling the culture war, because it's all about the narratives, right? That's why feminists care so much and leftists care so much about
culture. Derives from cult. It's what we worship. And yes, since we no longer worship God, because we for some reason ended up believing that we know better than 6,000 years of history, then we worship the rest of the culture. I mean, again, we still worship. This is a mistake that many of these new atheists, and again, I'm an atheist myself, but many new atheists have committed the mistake of saying that, oh, if we just get rid of the Christian influence, and if we just get rid of godly narratives, then everything will be honky-dory and civilization will progress. Well, as it turns out, that's not true. Because most people still want to worship. Yeah, sure, I don't want to worship. I don't need to worship. Maybe you don't need to, but most people do. Mm-hmm. And once you remove the overreaching narrative that was binding communities together and was binding the social classes together, I mean, the rich and the poor would still go to the same churches. They would still mingle with each other. That's no longer happening. And where is the other place where that's still happening? Well, it's in the cinema theaters. It's in the baseball games or football games here in Europe. It is what it is. That's what we worship. Mm-hmm. So as a result, of course, the totalitarian forces will want to subvert that as much as possible, because that's where the people's worship is, and that's where the narrative war is happening.
Right. And that's why so many of them are not just atheists, but anti-theists. And they want to while, you know, most people may not identify as feminist, this is the reason why they believe a lot of the narratives that feminists spin out, because you see it. Mm-hmm. They present these sort of, you know, these warped versions of reality in their media, in television, on the, you know, in film, and now it's, you know, expanded to video games and music, and it's everywhere. And so people are constantly there. That's how they have the advantage, I guess you could say, in the culture war, because most of the people in the entertainment industry are on the left. They're feminists, and they strongly believe in these ideas, or they're paid to believe these ideas, and then they share them with everyone else.
Or they're cowed into silence. I mean, I don't think that most people in the entertainment industry are on the left. I really don't, because I know a lot of people from the entertainment industry, and I know they're not. But they're cowed into silence, because in many countries, and the United States is the prime example to that, you cannot have a career unless you profess to be on the left. Now, I've seen this movie before. In the 1980s in communist Romania, it was pretty much the same thing. If you were to only look at what the mainstream was talking about, you would think that the entire country was communist, even though less than 20% of the country was even a member of the Communist Party, and even less than 10% were actually believer into that particular ideology. But you wouldn't know that, because everyone was cowed, or almost everyone, not everyone, of course, but most people were cowed into silence to at least practice as if they believe in whatever the Communist Party was putting out in that particular moment. And once the regime fell, you suddenly realize that it's not like 5% of the country is Orthodox Christian, but more like 85% of the country.
Right.
But if you were to ask the same question in 1988, 1 year before the regime fell, you would have think that at least 50% of the country is atheist. It wasn't. The same is true in here too, although this time it's financial pressure rather than physical pressure used to cow people into silence. But it works in similar fashion. You just cannot have a career in entertainment unless you at least successfully pretend practicing being on the left. That's why you see very few dissenting voices. I don't think they're necessarily all of them on the left, or even most of them. But enough of them are, and definitely enough of the movers and pushers. Because again, the financiers, those who finance a movie, do you think they care whether that movie has a feminist slant or a pro-action slant or a pro-male slant? They don't give a shit.
No, I don't think that producers do, no. I think that they tend to hire people who they think are going to make them money, and it just so happens that... I would assume that the reason why, I guess I assume that there's a lot of people that are at least... the majority seem to be either left of center or on the left firmly, is because they are educated in our colleges and universities, and in particular, our art, sort of like liberal arts colleges, tend to be very, very, Marxist and far mm-hmm. left. And so they get an education from that perspective, and that's what they bring. And I think that, like, I've seen plenty of examples of women and minorities in entertainment industry that, you know, they take that stance, they have that idea that it's important that women be represented in X way, and that, you know, blacks be represented in X way, and that what they're doing is so important. It's like part of a larger movement. It's their activism, etc. I don't think I think the producers just care about the bottom line, but I think there are useful idiots.
Of course. Yeah. Many of them are, for sure. Now, the reason I'm not buying that most of them are like that is because, again, most of the entertainment today is done pretty much by the same people that was done 10 or 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And 15 years ago, there was none of that bollocks. So, you know, no. I mean, if they were educated and they came from the universities as far left, why didn't they manifest as far left 15 years ago? Mm-hmm. it is something that was achieved much more recently through agitation and through subversion. More and more leftists intentionally got into these industries and started agitating and cowed everyone else into silence. The way to reverse that is using the same tools. This is my problem always with older conservatives or with older non-leftists in general, who say, oh, we shouldn't be doing that because that's the tool of the far left. Wrong. It is an amoral tool. Everyone can use it, and indeed, everyone who wants to win should use it.
Mm. Okay. I got a super chat from Mr. Roboto for $5 and says, feminism at this point is a religion. Once recognized and made official, then people can make an educated choice.
Mm. I don't know how you convince any government to declare it as a religion. I agree that it shares a lot of common traits with a religion,
a
for
cult,
sure.
More accurately, but yeah.
Or at the very least a cult, if not mm-hmm. a full-fledged religion. But getting a government to recognize it as a religion, that's a different story. Although admittedly, it would help in the propaganda war to have it declared as a religion and have it file for tax-exempt status as churches. That would help a lot. I agree.
The churches are called universities, women's studies departments specifically. But the I think that it's in terms of that the government finds it too useful because the feminism is very useful to the state because it's a way for them to expand. So they would the likelihood of getting of them declaring it as a religion is pretty slim since it's very handy for them.
Which is why it is important to practice agitprop and subversion and create new political parties or transform existent political parties mm-hmm. to get your own people there to control it. Mm-hmm. And this can be done. Of course, it takes between 20 and 50 years, but it can be done. This is what I'm working on right now. I mean, on my channel, you've seen several lectures that I did in several European capitals, and we'll do some more in the near future. It's precisely that, to teach people to subvert parties. And it can be done. Yes, it takes a lot of time. It requires patience, and it requires people willing to sign up for the next 40 years. Changing this, if it will be possible, again, it may, at the end of it, we might still fail. But if we don't try, we'll definitely fail. But changing this is not something that you do in 3 years or in 5 years. It requires decades of work. Because again, the reverse took decades as well.
Is it Yuri Bezmenov? Was that his name?
Yuri Bezmenov spoke about this like 30 years ago, but Herbert mm-hmm. Marcuse wrote Eros and Civilization, which is basically the blueprint of cultural Marxist subversion of the universities. He wrote it in 1953. Mm-hmm. And in 1972, so 20 years down the line, he was asked in an interview, how does he feel things are progressing towards his own point of view, and said, oh, we're still only in the beginning. Maybe another 20 or 30 years from now, we'll see the first results. He was right. The first results occurred in 1991, 92, and the first big results occurred after 2010. So 50 years, 60 years of hard work until it happened. So, you know, reversing that was going to have to take at the very least half of that time, if not as much as it took for them. And again, they did it 50 years considering that they had essentially no opposition, we're going to have to fight our opposition. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. It's a long thing. I mean, it's not something that I expect to see happening next year or in the next election. Or no, it's not how I look at things. I look at things for the next 20 years rather than the next election.
Yeah, or like a generation or something. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. think of it that way too. So do you think then that we at Honey Badger Brigade or AVFM, we should be doing something else? We should be changing our focus, or are we okay as we are?
I think you're in the right direction for sure. I mean, most of your audience is pretty young, which is mm-hmm. great. Because again, in terms of practical politics, it's nice when you find someone who's aged 60 or 65 that agrees with most of what you propose, but that person will vote in your direction maybe for the next three election cycles. Yeah. It's a lot more important to get someone who is 13 to agree with most of your points, because that person will vote in your direction for the next 30 election cycles.
Right. On top of the fact that someone who's 65 probably already agrees with you, because as you get older, you tend to like see how the real world works, and you tend to be against this kind of, you know, authoritarian stuff. I mean, there are some guys that like they never change, but I noticed that as people get older, they tend to become more libertarian.
Although that's not necessarily a rule. There are certainly there are definitely degrees to that as well, and there is some value in trying to change the minds of older people, because the minds of because older people have money and influence, and they can bankroll all of these operations. I mean, look at, for instance, Mr. Horowitz with his Liberty Center. I mean, the guy was a communist for 50 years, a militant communist, and he changed his mind when he was like 60. He's 80-something now. And because he changed his mind later in life, he had a lot of influence that he could now use in the service of non-leftist ideas. And he had a lot of money to bankroll operations that would subvert non-leftist ideas, and also a lot of wisdom and knowledge to teach the younger generation how the opposition actually works and where it is the most vulnerable, where are its Achilles heels, if you want. So you know, it is important to target older people as well. But for the long run, having mostly younger people watching it, at least agreeing in part, you'll never get anyone to agree 100% with you, but having them at least look at things through a different lens tends to help a lot. For instance, most of the work that I do in the field is to just plant the seed of doubt. I don't expect anyone to agree with me after one conversation or even after 10 conversations. But usually, I mean, just a few days ago, I got a series of like 5 or 6 emails from people with whom I spoke like 5 years ago. And almost all of them were like, oh, do you remember when I called you a moron and whatnot? Okay, now I've thought about things. And actually, yeah, there is a point to be made that, yeah, maybe I didn't know everything. And those individuals didn't end up agreeing with me 100% of the time. But they moved from 5% to 50%, which is important.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's get into a little bit of politics. And I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that I've been thinking about. So just to set it up, when I got first involved in this, and also in other things that are sort of, I think, entirely related, such as Gamergate, for example, and the election of Donald Trump, I did not see the MRA or MRM position as something that was inherently left-wing, right-wing, centrist, or whatever. But as I've met some MRAs that were, you know, centrist, center left, and all over the spectrum. But as I've been doing this a while, and I've been thinking a lot more about this sort of left right dichotomy, and I'm trying to let me be clear too, because I know that I'm trying to look at when I say left and right, I'm not saying from the perspective of United States politics, like Democrats and Republicans. I'm not talking about the various political parties in the UK or Canada or Europe. I'm just saying like the values, what I think are the values of the left and the values of the right. And my question is being a non-feminist or even anti-feminist men's rights activist, is it compatible with leftism at all?
No.
Okay.
No. And the reason I say that is because, again, on the left, the inherent value is equality of outcome. Mm-hmm. So no, anti-feminism cannot be compatible with leftism. Men and women are different, and individuals are different to each other, and the degree of difference between men is larger than the degree of difference between women. This is called the greater male variability theory. This is mainstream science. It's not something that I came up with yesterday. So as a result, any advocacy towards equality of outcome is fundamentally incompatible with understanding that feminism is bullcrap. So that's one aspect. Second aspect, leftism, the way it was outlined by Friedrich Engels and Karl Marx, is fundamentally anti-family. So as a result, when the MRA says, look, the family courts are biased and the family courts kind of suck, that is inherently anti-leftist, because from a leftist perspective, who cares whether it's the mother or the father that mostly gets the child? They're all equal anyway, when in reality, they're not. Children mm-hmm. do need, at the very least, an equal representation of a masculine role model and a feminine role model. Not to mention that leftism fundamentally disagrees that there is such thing as a masculine role model and a feminine role model. So I don't think it is compatible. Again, with leftism as understood by its primary forces, like Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, and also by its secondary forces, like Antonio Gramsci or Herbert Marcuse or Georg Lukács, it's just not compatible. I mean, the first cultural Marxist government in the world was Georg Lukács' government in Hungary in 1919. And one of the first things that they did was precisely to introduce sex ed and this kind of sexual egalitarianism in the schools. And it's okay if you have sex before marriage. It's okay if you do this. And again, that may sound great for people like us who are urbanites and things like that. But once you introduce that to the wider civilizational scale, that's terrible. Mm-hmm. So anti-feminism in particular is not compatible with leftism as leftism is. Now, of course, in the United States, you have many who are nominally leftists, but not really. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is probably a leftist, and definitely the people behind her are indeed leftists. But mm-hmm. is Kirsten Gillibrand a leftist? No. Mm-hmm. Is Nancy Pelosi a leftist in the way leftism actually is? No. They're just not.
That's why I say that it's not. That's why I made that distinction between leftists and Democrats, because the Democrats, they want power, obviously. Mm-hmm. They're willing to play dirty to get it, but of that course. Doesn't necessarily make them progressives,
Many of them are leftists, but definitely not all of them. Mm-hmm. Just like many Republicans are conservatives and capitalists, but not all of them.
No, not all of them, no.
There are many in the Republican Party who have a very socialist way of looking at the mm-hmm. world. So there's that. But the way leftism actually is necessarily has to be incompatible with anti-feminism and with men's rights. And again, this is a question that has been answered more than 100 years ago by Ernest Belfort Bax. Ernest Belfort Bax was a Marxist attorney from the United Kingdom, who wrote two very important books for the non-feminist thought, namely The Legal Subjugation of Men, published in 1896, I think, and the more important The Fraud of Feminism, published in 1913. And the guy was a Marxist. And towards the end of his life, he had to admit that he has to either remain a men's rights activist or to remain a socialist. There's just no way to reconcile the two. And he died before answering that question. But the questions he posed one or two years before he died ended up being responded by the history itself, the way Soviet Union played out, essentially. Mm-hmm. You have to remember in the Soviet Union, when Lenin got into power, got all of these progressive practices into the country, and the country almost collapsed. And after the war, and even before the World War II, Stalin had to go to get the country back towards a less progressive, socially progressive worldview in order for him to still have a country to lead. Mm. Now, of course, the way Stalin did that is of a separate story. But then again, yeah.
Okay, so It's interesting that you say that about leftism. I watch a lot of Jordan B. Peterson appearances, and one of the questions that he has tried to get addressed over and over and over in public appearances is he's trying to identify when the left goes too far. That was his statement, right? He says he thinks that there's value in it, but he says, I want to know when it goes too far. And he says, in my mind, it's when they ask for equality of outcome. And you're saying that the left in its nature asks for equality of outcome at its outset. So it's not even a matter of mm-hmm. degrees or a spectrum. Now, mm-hmm. on the other side of this, another thing that Peterson says is that I know what it looks like when the right goes too far, and he compares it to Nazism or fascism. But I think that Nazism and fascism were also left-wing ideologies, if I remember correctly.
They definitely were.
Yeah, and
about 4 years ago, I made a video called Fascism is Progressive, in which I basically read out loud the Fascist Manifesto as written by Benito Mussolini, the founder of fascism.
Yeah.
And it sounds like any social democratic political party in Europe.
Yeah. And on top of that, there was something else too. Oh, yeah, the alt-right. The alt-right is also leftist and socialist.
In most cases, yes.
They are.
They are the alternative to the mainstream right.
Yes.
And where does that alternative necessarily have to go?
Yeah, it has to go left. I mean, that's why they're essentially, the thing that I bring up to sort of make my point about the alt-right is the alt-right are ethno-nationalists that want to have social programs, redistribution of wealth, but they just want it for their people. But Pan-African socialists like Black Lives Matter advocates yep. also want an ethno-state with social programs for their people. And yet we mm-hmm. see Black Lives Matter as on the left and we see the alt-right as on the right for some reason. I think that they're both on the left. They're just when you take socialism and add racism, it doesn't make it a right-wing ideology.
and it doesn't make it any less socialism.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't change that either.
I mean, so, the greatest disagreement between the Third Reich and the USSR was with whom do we start the purges?
Exactly.
The USSR believed that we should start with the kulaks and maybe Jews at the end of it, whereas the Third Reich. Believe that we should start with the Jews and maybe we'll talk about the kulaks towards the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically, and of course, you know, people who are interested in having power over you so that they can like take your wealth and redistribute it and also give a little bit for their own party hate other people that want to do the same thing because they don't want them to muscle in their territory. Yeah, exactly. So naturally the communists and the Nazis didn't like each other. So anyway,
although they kind of did at the beginning. I mean, look at the documentary "The Soviet Story," made in Estonia in 2008. It's in English, where you see even during World War II, top tier Nazi generals having a toast with top tier Soviet generals. I mean, the Third Reich learned about the concept of concentration camps from the Soviet Union, which already had about 20 years of experience in having concentration camps. So, you know, they started hating each other only when they started competing on the same topic, namely Poland
right.
at the beginning. And that's when they started hating each other.
Okay. All right. Cool. So then my big thing that I've been thinking a lot about, and it seems like you've done a lot of reading on it, and I've been thinking about it and from a just sort of like, you know, giving it some thought about this whole left-right dichotomy and how the conversation around it in the larger sort of mainstream discourse is so distorted. And I'm trying to, and even people that people regard as, you know, intellectual titans like Jordan B. Peterson, who I think is really good at what he does in a lot of ways, but I think he gets this left-right thing wrong. And he, you know, it gets
he's a product of our times at the end of the day. So,
yes.
Course.
Yeah. And so, something else, actually, since we're talking about the subversion and everything, one other thing that the left is really good at or has been very good at, and maybe this is another tactic that, you know, you might be suggesting that we adopt, is their manipulation of language. And so they have changed what words mean. They have used postmodernism to make them make everyone confused when they're talking to each other about certain things. This is why, you know, when someone says left, people have like, you know, all different ideas on what that means. A lot of the time people think being left just means being a good person. A lot of people think that it's communism. A lot of people think that it's it's the same as liberalism, or it's the same as it's Democrats or whatever. And I think that's just one example, but they have done such an incredible job of warping our ability to communicate with each other that it's just made, it's like the Tower of Babel, if I might be so inclined, right, to say. And I guess like, is that something that we can also try to do? And maybe what I want to do is fix language. So I try to be very sort of anal about what my words are and be very specific in defining them when I talk to people, because I'm trying to untie that giant rat's nest of language that's behind the, you know, computer of our civilization.
Yeah, one of the reasons I've already answered to like three, maybe four of your questions, even though we've been online for 1 hour, is because I spent a lot of time defining what I mean.
Yes.
And again, your questions are very long-winded because you define what you mean. That's one of the things that necessarily has to become, again, the habit in every conversation. For instance, when for starters, I don't debate with leftists unless there is an audience. If there is no audience, I don't care what the leftist has to say. I just ignore it because it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
But when I debate leftists with an audience, I always criticize the language first. So what do you mean by that? What do you mean by equality? What do you mean by fairness? What do you mean by progress? What do you mean by that? And I ask them to define them as strictly as possible, dare I say, as conservatively as possible. Define your terms. And once we agree on the definitions, if we agree on the definitions, then we can have a chat. That's why, for instance, I contested your definition when you said, oh, most artists are on the left. No, they're not. Because, again, we always look at these things and always criticize the language first. What do you mean by that? Jordan B. Peterson is doing that oftentimes, and it's good that he's doing it, but he doesn't do it often enough, in my opinion. Although, again, he's constricted with many of his TV appearances are time constricted.
Yes.
Also,
yes.
Oftentimes he's intentionally taken out of context. But then again, everyone has to be accustomed to that. It's always going to happen, especially when dealing with totalitarians. But nevertheless, it is very important. This is the first thing that it should become a habit to anyone. And as for the language itself, you've probably noticed it even on me. I always say the non-left. I don't say the right. And the reason I don't say the right is because then someone could legitimately ask me, what is the right? And that's a clusterfuck.
Good luck
defining that. But the non-left, that's easy.
Yeah.
Everyone who doesn't subscribe to mainstream leftism is a non-leftist. Libertarians are non-leftists. Capitalists are non-leftists. You know, Thatcherite type of authoritarians are non-leftist. It's a lot easier, and it's also a broader umbrella, because at this point, it is basically the non-left, the wider non-leftist majority against a minuscule but very powerful and very vocal leftist minority. And also, it helps a lot with the framing, because once you put things into this perspective, it becomes easier to see just how radical the leftist perspective is. Once you realize that, hold on a second. So who actually believes that men can become women? Oh, it's about 2% of the population. So then it becomes easier to pitch this to a politician, because again, what's the point of this? To influence politicians.
Right.
So when I tell to a politician, no, you should vote against this and agitate against it. And they're like, yeah, but look at what they're saying on social media. Yeah, that's 2% of the population. And then the politician is like, okay, fair enough. I can afford to lose at most 2 percentage points.
Yeah.
But and the other way around is, I mean, you can see with them, that's why the left is trying to subvert the language so hard. Because once they subvert the definition of languages, it makes it easier for them to frame the things as if they are the majority position, when they're clearly not. So, you know, once you say, oh, leftism is basically liberalism, yeah, a lot of people are liberals, but very few people are leftists.
Yes, yes. There's an important distinction there. I make it all the time. I think that you can actually be liberal and conservative at the same time. I don't think they're opposites.
Conservatism, as especially modern conservatives, post-1970 conservatism, let's put it this way, both in Europe and North America, is essentially a branch of liberalism. Because, you know, that's the civilization we live in. Of course, but again, not all conservatives are necessarily a branch of liberals. I mean, some conservatives are, for instance, the neo-reactionaries. Mm-hmm. Those are not necessarily liberals. Some of them are, but many aren't. So, what is a conservative? Be precise in your language.
Right.
It's a huge clusterfuck. That's why I prefer the term non-leftist, because everyone understands what I mean by non-leftist.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, no, that actually makes a lot of sense. That's fair.
And again, I borrowed that from the tactics we're using
non-feminist.
Non-feminist. Yes. There you go. Same thing. I just expanded it a little bit.
Yeah. I get it. And it essentially has the effect of sort of exposing how small the left is, and politicians, they care about votes, right? So if they see that that's not a lot of votes, then they're, you know, probably not going to care that much. So I guess we've gone for an hour. I want to, end on a couple of other questions maybe, and then we can just like wrap it up. So with what we've got, we've made some progress. I think that the Trump administration is doing some really great work in specifically addressing, men's issues in that, for example, he's talking about prison reform. That's going to affect men mostly. There was talk about, well, obviously, Betsy DeVos is doing great work for the education system. And so we are making, and this is despite, again, the narrative that he was a serial rapist and, you know, he was grabbing women and he still got elected in. And there were a lot of women that voted for him.
That's why the left is so out of control with trying to undermine Trump. Mm-hmm. Because they cannot have it that someone comes in and just craps all over their narrative and still gets elected. Mm-hmm. Because that exposes to a lot of people all over the world, not just the United States, that hold on a second, you don't have to practice, we don't have to pretend that you subscribe to the lunacy of those people. As it turns out, most people don't give a shit. Sorry for interrupting.
No, it's okay. So I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, there is a lot of good that I'm seeing. For example, something I was going to bring up earlier, leftist outlets like the Young Turks, like CNN, like these sorts of, you know, media organizations, they originally dismissed MRAs and MRA talking points outright. Now, even when they're trying to make arguments against them, they acknowledge the existence of men's issues. They say, yes, men have issues. They talk about father's rights. They talk about circumcision. They talk about suicide. Even if they try to spin it into something that men are doing to themselves and they're trying to like work it into their sort of patriarchy framework, but they are talking about it. So that means that they can't ignore it anymore. I mean, Cassie J's movie, you know, is difficult to ignore. People have to respond. So I agree that there has been more progress than I expected. But here's the thing I'm wondering about. What do you think, based on the work that you've been doing? So you've sort of, it seems to me, expanded your the discussion to not just being sort of like a pro-MRM, anti-feminist or non-feminist one, but rather it's more become like a larger thing about the left in general and pushing back on leftists by making these sort of, you know, talking about subversion and the ways in which we can sort of, you know, change the narrative, as it were. And then hopefully downstream from that will become all the other changes that are necessary, looking at this long game. What do you think the people that work within the manosphere, within the MRM, that are men's advocates, I'm not talking about MGTOW or PUAs, because they're going to do what they're going to do, but like men's advocates, what should we be doing now? What should we change our focus? Should we just keep doing what we're doing? What do you think?
It depends on, because again, in terms of practical politics, it really does depend on how much money you have and how many people you have in your organization. Mm. For instance, my influence grew exponentially in the last 2 years, precisely because I had enough people wanting to join in. I still don't have the funding that I would want, but I do have now enough people willing to do things. And once you have enough people, then you can expand on things. So for instance, what I have been advising, especially the 2 months from now, I'll be having a very long conference with few of the men's rights people in Germany. MRAs in Germany have been very successful in achieving court victories to overturn family courts' monopolies on things. And their victories have had a deeply positive, tangible effect on the way family courts operate within Germany and to a certain extent within the rest of Europe too. They won a few cases at the European Court of Human Rights as well. But that's a very narrow focus because you really need very good lawyers to achieve that. Mm-hmm. You may have 1 million members. If you don't have three good lawyers, it still doesn't matter. But largely, this is what I always advise people, both in private and in conferences, get as many of your people as possible in as many political parties as possible. Again, this is a tactic that has been successfully used by Vladimir Lenin in 100 years ago, basically to control both or all three or all four sides of the debate. Mm-hmm. And this is something that sounds very nasty when you put it this way, but it works. I mean, there should be pro-male voices distinctly pro-male voices in the Democrat Party, in the Republican Party, and in the Libertarian Party. Mm-hmm. And of course, I know many MRAs that are like, oh, but I can't join a political party. It's better to be independent and whatnot. Yeah, sure. If you want to win 150 years from now, go ahead and be independent and pure and an angel. But, you know, if you want to win, working on controlling or at the very least influencing as many sides of the debate as possible, that's slightly better. And again, the fact that the CNN now, or even I think it was it the plural? No, I think Vice was when they said when they had a title, how Kanye West's red pilling did whatever. And it was with no scare quotes. They just used the word red pilling as if everyone understood what that means.
Right.
That's a huge propaganda victory. When you get the opposition to speak your language, that's a very good propaganda victory. Mm-hmm. And again, this should continue, and this should continue by introducing as many people of our own in as many conversations as possible. Because when I say subverting institutions, I don't just mean NGOs; I mean political parties as well and companies. Mm-hmm. For instance, now I have in the Freedom Alternative Network, there are a few people who are human resources officers in big corporations, and those people get to decide a lot of things. And again, it's a step by step, tiny steps approach. Again, the results are not spectacular by individual, but when you look at it overall over the next 10 years, for instance, the results are and will continue to be quite spectacular. So that's something that should be done. I mean, you shouldn't be encouraging your audience to become HR officers or communicators for various political parties. Because again, the communicator, the PR guy, that's the person that actually controls the message of a political party. Mm-hmm. It's not the politicians. It is the propaganda officer. Every political party has a propaganda officer. Now, of course, they don't call it a propaganda officer anymore because there was that socialist from the Third Reich that made the word very not great to be used in public. Now they call it the party communicator or the words bearer or the PR officer, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's still the propaganda officer. And that's the person that usually controls most of the messaging of any political party. Not all of it, but most of it. Mm-hmm. And it would help quite a lot if the propagandist of a political party is a non-leftist or is an MRA or both. That can be done with the view, again, in the end, to have, for instance, the Republicans and Democrats arguing whether circumcision should stay legal. That's a victory. Mm-hmm. This already happened to a certain extent in Germany, for instance. In Germany, the German MRAs have been able to introduce their people in all political parties, and they had a huge debate about 5 years ago, I think. No, maybe a little bit less, when circumcision was made illegal by court decision. And then all the political parties had to argue whether it should stay legal or not. And there were a lot of propagandists from all political parties who argued that it shouldn't. And in the end, it ended up with a restriction of the activity. And many Germans then perceived it as a defeat. But I said, no, hold on a second. You got restrictions for it. 5 months ago, there was no restrictions on it. Now you wait, and for another 3 years or 4 years down the line, you try again, and you get even more restrictions. I mean, these things take time to change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you think then, okay, so we at HBR, we have some people that are our subs and our patrons, but not a lot of money, not a lot of influence. So I guess what we're working on is just growing the channel and growing the influence. It's difficult because I think that we're not only a little bit unpopular because MRA still has a little bit of a bad stink on it for other people on YouTube. I think so anyway. I mean, for example, I don't know, there are people like that have large platforms that we could get on and talk to that know about us but don't want to get us on. I remember Joe Rogan, for example, was going to have Karen on, and then he pulled out, and he said that he would organize it something else, but that was like 3 or 4 years ago, and he never reached out to her again. I think that for him,
this would be a very good moment to try again. Reach out to him. I mean, you know, 4 years ago was 4 years ago. In the meantime, the guy had Alex Jones twice on it on the channel, yeah. And he had plenty of militant non-leftists on his channel. So, you know, today Karen wouldn't be such a radical presence, as opposed to 4 years ago, when yes, most of his content was, you know, fighters related and pretty left leaning, and you know, 4 years ago it was a different societal standard. Mm-hmm. At Joe Rogan Experience, today is a different standard, and within today's standard, which was definitely moved a little bit, or I would say a little bit more, Karen would be a much better fit. And yeah, you should reach out to him again.
Yeah, we're trying to get on to larger platforms. Like Steven Crowder had Karen on a couple of times, and so mm-hmm. you know, and his platform's very large now too. So yeah, but we are working on that stuff. So that's it's good to hear that. Also, I guess lastly, because I heard there's some activity, and we're an hour and 14 minutes in. I think we're starting to wind down. But I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing this info. It was a very interesting conversation. But a couple of quick fire questions, okay? What do you think about the results of the Mueller Russia investigation?
Not surprised at all.
No, of course not. What do you think about the media reaction to it? Like, if you're a leftist propagandist, how do you respond to that? Right.
Well, you don't. I mean, seriously, if I were to work in the propaganda department of a left wing organization, I would go into full deflection mode. I wouldn't respond. I mean, the way that this tells me that the left is very weak at this point in time, which is surprisingly weak. I expected them to become weaker, but I didn't expect them to become that weak that fast. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Maybe they're smarter people that just deserted. I don't know what happened. But you know, if I were a leftist propagandist, I were working for CNN, for instance, I would go into full deflection. I would start reporting on some weird events in the middle of the country.
Yeah,
just everything to get the Mueller investigation out of the agenda. That's exactly what I would do.
Yeah.
Sadly for them, they chose the worst possible way to
double down
about it. Yeah, yeah. No, yeah. Doubling down is good sometimes, but this is not one of those cases. As for the result itself, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, I called for it the second it started. I even wagered on it. I have a few money to recover. Next week, I'm going to be very busy calling the people who owe me money to give me my money, because I'm going to need those.
Yeah, no, it's obvious it was all bullshit, but I was just curious about that. I was more interested in the media reaction. I wasn't surprised by the result. What about Jussie Smollett? Did you hear about what happened with him?
Yes. I'm not surprised at all.
That he was cleared of all charges, yeah.
Yes, I'm not surprised at all. I mean, Chicago is a very, very corrupt place.
I know. I'm in Chicago.
I know.
It's the most corrupt city in the country, I think, or one of them.
I don't know if it's the most corrupt, but definitely very corrupt, even by European standards, and we're pretty corrupt over here. But you know, last year when I was in Chicago, I was given a tour, if you want, by several people who are in the real estate business, and they told me how things work there and the level of corruption. I'm like, even Ukraine is less corrupt than that when you want to build something. And then I got friends, well, not necessarily friends, but definitely, you know, pen pals, if you want. And I kept on talking with a few people who are in the higher echelons of the Chicago PD. And the things that they told me, I'm like, Christ almighty. I mean, you know, that kind of corruption, I could imagine it in the 1980s Italy. Mm-hmm. But definitely not today in the United States. I mean, the level of corruption at all levels in Chicago land, so not just Chicago City, but also the surroundings, is pretty astounding. So I'm not surprised that Jussie Smollett was let go. Now, I'm expecting, however, that the federal authorities to get into the game, because now it's clear for them to get there. I mean, the guy also committed a few federal felonies as well, didn't he? I mean, charging checks.
Every charge was dropped. All of them. Mm. I think it was
including the federal ones, because time I checked,
the FBI is looking into that, but I haven't heard anything about that. Yeah, the FBI is investigating him, but I don't know where that's going to go. And also, the FBI isn't exactly clean either.
Oh yeah.
So
that's true, but then again, compared to what? I mean, compared to my standards, yes. But compared to the Chicago PD, come on.
It is. And even the mayor and the chief of police got up and they made statements saying that they were really shocked and appalled, but I mean they're just as bad. They're probably just cleaning their own. Oh, either that or they saw, wow, this really went further than I would have wanted in terms of, like, I don't want to show everyone how corrupt we are. Guys, calm down. So that's what I think, because Rahm Emanuel is, he's not clean.
To put it mildly.
Yes. Yes, to put it mildly. Okay, and I think that I had, there may have been one more thing. I can't think of it, though. So, I guess that's it. I want to say thanks again, Lucian, for coming on the show. And I hope, would you come back on if I asked you to come on again after your tour is over and everything, you know?
Yeah, it's going to have to be about 3 months from now. I mean, just next week, I'm leaving towards Ukraine and Moldova, because, you know, having this level of knowledge requires refreshing them from time to time. I have to travel a lot. And then I'll go for 2 weeks in Germany to refresh my knowledge on Germany. And then I'm looking to get Freedom Alternative accredited to the Intermarium Summit, which is pretty much the biggest geopolitical event, at least for the first half of the year, in this area of the world. The 3Cs Initiative is the official name of it. And after the 3Cs Initiative Summit, I should be able to get back to it. I mean, even having videos at a decent pace on the channel is pretty difficult in this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remembered the last question now. So because you're going to be traveling, you said Europe mostly?
Yes. Entirely Europe.
Entirely Europe. So, yeah, you're going to be touring in Europe. So you might. European Union passed Article, I think it's 17, 13 and 11, right? Mm-hmm. And there's only one more vote before it becomes sort of like enshrined or whatever, from what I've heard. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's a bit more complicated than that. First of all, there is no one more vote. This was the vote. Then again, after something passes through the European Parliament, it's usually a 2-year period for the member states of the what I call the EUSSR, or what they call the European Union, to enshrine their own versions in the national legislation. So there will be a lot of variance between the member states. That's usually the case with almost any European policy. Now, whether that will happen or not is a separate story, just like it is a separate story whether Article 13 in particular is even enforceable. My position has always been that it cannot be enforced, because the costs of doing that are just astronomical. I don't think I'm not particularly worried by it. Of course, I think it's despicable that such thing is even considered, but I'm not particularly concerned about it.
Oh, okay. So you think that
again, it's a my bit, position it's a, is minority the, position. Most people are deeply concerned about
yes,
it. I'm
yes.
not.
And why not?
Again, because implementing it the way it is written is essentially impossible. And on the other hand, I think there is another European policy that is a lot more harmful to the internet than Article 13, namely the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, which is already in force, and it's fucking up with my internet. I can't read certain American websites, for instance, because they're not GDPR compliant. So I think that one is a lot worse than Article 13. With that said, it's mostly in the state of we'll see what happens. I mean,
okay.
I don't know. It is way too early to tell. We will have to wait for whatever EU state becomes the first one to actually try to put it through the national legislation. And then we can comment a bit further. Until then, of course, there is the European elections on May 26th. Make sure you don't vote for the people who voted in favor of Article 13. That's something that every EU citizen can do right away.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, all right. Well, thank you for your thoughts on that. I just want to make sure I didn't forget to ask it. We're going to go ahead and get out of here. So I want to thank Lucien Valsan for coming on. The Twitter is Freedom Alternate. The website is freedomalternative.com. And the YouTube channel is also Freedom Alternative. So it's easy to find the content. Check it out. There's lots of long videos. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I want to thank you guys for joining us. Please give this video a like, subscribe to the channel, hit the bell for notifications, and share, comment. I want to hear your thoughts on our discussion. What do you guys think about, essentially using their tactics against them, subvert alternative politics? I think that it actually has a lot of merit and it's something worth considering. So please expand your conversation in the comments. And I look forward to seeing what you guys think. We'll talk to you guys later. Thanks for coming on the Fireside Chat.